Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Mary Beth Cooper, the 13th president of Springfield College, Springfield, Massachusetts. Dr. Cooper earned a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Delaware, a Master's in Education from the University of Georgia, a Master of Business Administration from the University of Rochester, a Doctorate in Philosophy and Education Administration from Michigan State University, and a Doctor of Management from Case Western Reserve University. She previously served as a Senior Vice President for Student Affairs at Rochester, New York Institute of Technology, RIT, and is Chair of the YMCA of Greater Rochester Board of Directors. Cooper co-led the RIT President's Commission on Women to Improve the Campus Climate for Women, is a past recipient of the RIT Four Presidents Distinguished Public Service Award, and was named one of Rochester's most influential women by the Rochester Business Journal. Known for her volunteer leadership, President Cooper has been named to National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities Committee on Policy Analysis and Public Relations, as well as to the Board of Trustees of the Council for Adult and Experimental Learning. She was appointed by Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker to serve on the Special Commission to study the incorporation of safe and effective pain treatment and prescribing practices into the professional training of students that may prescribe controlled substances. With Dr. Cooper's leadership comes her vision for Springfield College, an inclusive campus that encourages pluralism and engaged and diverse populations and thought. She's shared governance and use of the study circle method of collaborative and democratic decision-making among faculty, staff, and students, and undertaken a new and innovative approach to enrollment management and institutional branding, student body, and the integrity of the institution. We'll talk with Dr. Mary Beth Cooper about all of this and much more, but first, welcome, Dr. Mary Beth Cooper.
I thought we were done. That pretty much summed it up, don't you think?
Send it to all the relatives. shall I call you Dr. Cooper?
Or no,
shall I
call please you call me Mary Beth.
Okay. So let me start with the fact that if any time in American history we were talking about the year of the woman, this is it. And you have acceded to a top position, a president of a major college. Do you feel you had to work harder than a man would have had to work to get there?
I don't know that I had to work harder. I often say, and I was the first president of this institution, that they were probably ready for a female president. But to be honest and not to be flip about it, I'm not sure they were ready for a first man. So that when, you know, traditionally at Springfield College, like many other four-year privates, there have been a couple, and the president was the male, and then the first lady did a lot of the things to help do some of the hospitality, do some of the, again, many duties and responsibilities that we've learned first in my first year that fell to her or she was gracious enough to do. My husband doesn't do any of that. And so what they often ask, what will we call him? We call him Dave. And he actually still lives in New York State. He works out of Rochester. And we commute back and forth. He commutes back and forth to Springfield. So we're longtime residents of New York State and enjoy the fact that he has his position and he helps me support mine. And so I would say I think I worked hard to get where I am, but I don't know that I worked any harder than a male.
Well, it sounds to me like you did. I mean, it sounds to me like you have more than one doctorate. This is very unusual. I slaved for mine, and I would never have gone and done another one if my life depended on it. And you did all of those things. Are you a natural-born student? I mean, do you like to learn?
I do like to learn. And honestly, for me, we had, as I was mentioning, my husband's in Rochester. We were in Rochester for 25 years, and he, during that time, built his business. And so for me professionally, I wasn't going to leave Rochester because I liked my marriage and I liked our family there. And so getting additional degrees helped me professionally develop. And so my places of employment were kind enough to let me do that. And each one of those degrees opened up another opportunity for me and helped me prepare me really for the role of presidency. Those degrees in management supplemented and augmented my student development theory and what I understood about education, but there's a business side of higher education that you need to pay attention to. And so from my perspective, it was really leading me to a presidency, although if you'd asked me 5 years ago, would I be a college president, I'm not sure that that would have been first out of my mouth.
Do you remember the interview when you got the job? Do you remember the Board of Trustees asking you questions?
I do, and I've said this to them. There were a number of people that weren't quite sure that a female was the right choice. And then there were a number that were adamant that it was time. And so what brought me to Springfield College is we have a long history of working with the YMCA. We started as a training school for CEOs of YMCA. And so in 1885, that was how we began. And I'm a long-serving volunteer with the YMCA in Rochester. And so I believe my candidacy offered somebody that understood the YMCA and the movement there and understood higher education. And so both of those probably worked out well for me in the interview because I was able to talk about both and the missions of both of those organizations. And we're still in deep partnership with them.
Were there men on the selection committee?
There were.
Women? I mean, you know, you had to size the group up when you went in there. Any smart person would. Did you think, oh, God, I'm in trouble, or this is good?
There was one individual and a great friend of the college, but he was in construction and wondered if I was going to be able to manage all the issues of deferred maintenance and some of the issues around construction. And my husband works with contractors, and so I understand it quite well. And so when I started to mention something that I'd read in an ENR, which is their trade magazine, it piqued his interest that I might understand deferred maintenance and I might understand the issues we have surrounding embedding technology. Where will we go with that? And I probably had to prove to him that I had the intellect and the stamina for the job. But he was convinced, or seems to be that way.
Springfield College, it seems to me, has a brand. One of the brands is basketball. Is that a problem or is that good for you?
We are the birthplace of basketball. And I understood that as well when I came, because you wouldn't miss it. We have a large arch that says it. Welcome to Springfield College, birthplace of basketball. I was concerned when I first came because I think students today don't choose colleges because basketball happened to be invented on our campus. It, as I have framed it, it's a fun fact. And it's certainly fun around the selection process and the big dance, Final Four, to talk a little bit about it. We have tried to leverage that as best we can in terms of, I sit on the Hall of Fame, the Basketball Hall of Fame, and we've done some great educational programs with them on our campus. 2 years ago, Shaq came on campus, Dr. O'Neill came on campus and talked too. And the students, we brought high school students in from the city and our college students, and he talked about the value of education. And so when you hear from Shaq how important education is, it resonates a lot better than if you're hearing it from me. And so finding the role models to bring on campus and talk about the value of education that happen to also be basketball players, you can't beat it.
Okay, but if you're on the board, National Basketball Hall of Fame, and you bring a Shaq, Dr. Shaq, as you say, to talk to your people, that's great. But some of these people, some of the guys who were there, have had not flattering things written about them. One guy I remember talked about having been with 1,000 women.
Correct.
Does that enter into your thinking about whether or not they are proper honorees of the Basketball Hall of Fame?
Well, certainly I was not a part of that process in terms of selecting
that individual.
But I think you have to be very careful with your athletes. And we are very conscious of our brand at Springfield College. And so bringing Shaq in, not only was it fun, it was a nice moment. All of the individuals that are enshrined, and he came in for his enshrinement, do a day of service. And so they come and they either go to a middle school or they come to Springfield College. They do service the day they're enshrined. They've embedded that in the program for the athletes. We do have an opportunity to select who we'd like to invite on campus. So we had Rebecca Lobo this year. She was enshrined, and she came and talked about growing up in Connecticut and how basketball has shaped her life and talked about her husband. I mean, she was entertaining and also a good role model. So when we think about branding, we've just, and I'm not sure if you've heard of this, but we have partnered with the Ripken Foundation, Cal Ripken Senior Foundation out of Baltimore. We had an opportunity to work with them on building a new baseball complex on our campus. Now they are building 200 youth parks around the country in the next 5 years. Youth parks in cities all over the United States.
And a youth park is?
A baseball field that does educational program. And so some of those parks have an ability field either attached or down around the corner so that individuals with disabilities would be able to play baseball, Miracle League, for example, or Special Olympics. And so I learned of this and made a pitch to the foundation to have them build one of their youth parks on our campus. We were in desperate need for a baseball field for our athletes, and they're expensive. And so the foundation we were able to partner with them, the very first college that's partnered with them, and we cut the ribbon on it about a month ago. Cal Ripken Jr. came up and cut the ribbon. And so Cal Ripken is another person that's a sport athlete that we like to brand with him, right? He shows persistence and going to work every day, the Iron Man of baseball. He gives back an awful lot to the community of Baltimore, always has in his career. And so it is certainly risky when you partner with some individuals because you don't know what what else you're going to find out, right? You know that more today than any other day. And so the good news about that is, so we now have an ability field that actually is the very first of its kind. It's embedded into our baseball field. So if you looked at it, you would see the baseball diamond, and then you would see a second field that's embedded. Same turf, same qualifications, same specifications. And so when the Miracle League comes and plays, and they have on our campus.
And the Miracle League, once again, Mary Beth, is?
Individuals, youth individuals that have disabilities.
Okay, go ahead.
So they come and they play. And it's a message back to the community that it's access. A baseball field, for example, and one of the things that I think is important is our relationship with the community. The baseball field sits empty from about May 1 to September 1 when the students come back. Why not have the youth in the community have access to it? And so we've put in a situation now that, again, Special Olympics, Miracle League can come and play on our field all summer long so it doesn't sit underutilized. And they were reluctant at first, and now I'm on the Ripken Foundation, so I serve on that board to work with the college and university, because sometimes colleges and universities can be rigid and want to use their own contractors and have different barriers that are in place. And we worked really hard, my team worked really hard to make as seamless as possible. And so now they have called it the Springfield model, and we're talking to other colleges and universities about doing that same field. And I'm not going to name the schools because I don't want to get ahead of myself, but mostly in urban settings so that youth have a place to go, and especially Springfield, that, you know, we certainly have that capability as well, that's safe. And so we want to use sport, all the way back to your comments about basketball, as an avenue or a medium to make sure that we make it connected to education and how they're a great partnership.
What sport do you engage in personally?
I'm a runner. I've done some I've done some half marathons and a marathon, a swimmer. High school. I love sport, and we have a strong reputation. About 40% of our students are athletes, but their GPA is either as high or higher in the last 4 years than our non-student athletes. They're in every major, PA, PT, they're involved in, and they graduate. So for me, you know, I'm a fan more of Division III. Obviously, you see that I've been to some Division I schools, but I love Division III because they're student athletes. And they're fun. They're disciplined. They're dedicated. So,
have the coaches ever tried to inveigle you into helping recruit a promising athlete?
I have talked to athletes as I walk around campus, but not specifically. Given that we don't give scholarships, it makes it easier.
Yeah. So tell me about your parents.
Okay. My mother's from Albany and my father's from Glens Falls. They both have since passed. My dad was an FBI agent.
Really?
So that brought us to D.C., and I grew up in D.C. So I have five older brothers. They all live in the D.C. area, with the exception of one.
And so five older brothers, no sisters?
Correct.
Wow.
So you can see that starts to plant the seeds for some interest in sport.
And for competition.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're not going to push me around.
Correct. And I have a very tall husband.
Is that right?
Who played college ball.
I'll remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I want to know about who you are, because I know being a college president or even the head of a public radio station can be lonely at times. In other words, you have to make some decisions that are not going to go over well with everybody. You know, I mean, in the introduction I read about you, there was mention of your philosophy about how to be inclusive with the faculty. But there's some point in which somebody doesn't get tenure, right?
Correct. Or a program doesn't move forward.
Yeah.
Right? And so we're in that process right now. We're doing a program review, and you're absolutely right. I often say it looks so popular on Facebook or Instagram or all the social media. Yeah. But it is, at the end of the day, I think a very lonely position that only the person that's living it can understand. You wonder who to trust and who you can trust, right? So oftentimes a good confidant, and that my dog serves in that capacity.
Mine too.
Right. And he's very reassuring about the decisions I make, and he never talks back, right? So it's good.
Oh, no, mine does. Yeah. Oh.
So I think you get used to it. I'm not sure before I lived in, and I live on campus, and so I...
Some college presidents don't live on campus.
Big mistake.
It is because?
Well, for example, we have some challenges right now with technology, and we're working on that, and we've got a plan in place. But I live on campus, and so I have the same challenges the students do, right? Because I'm using the same technology.
Right.
And I work out in the wellness center 5 days a week, And I understand because it's right across the street. For me, it's a good opportunity for me to engage with the students and see what's going on, what the temperament's like, how people are feeling. And in the 4 years I've been there, students very rarely approach me in the wellness center. They will at the dining hall, and I am in there once a day as well, usually lunch or early dinner. I have to be connected to the students because I need to know what's on their mind. And so if you don't live on campus, you know, once you get in your car and you drive home, the likelihood of you driving back is not likely.
Did your mom work?
She did as we got older. She was an office manager. Uh-huh. But as you can imagine, with that size, it wasn't until I was probably middle school till she went back, given my father's schedule.
Right, I would assume. Let's talk a little bit about how you manage faculty. Is there something that allows for joint decision-making? I mean, look, I was a professor for many years in my life, and I always like to say, whatever the president wants, assuming I like the president, I want to do. I want the president to be in charge of the place. There were faculty I served with who said, oh, he or she didn't ask about this, and they're just trying to get over on us and push us around. That's got to be tough, right?
It is. And I think sometimes the faculty will give the president more credit, like that I would somehow be plotting at home at night how I might make their life very difficult, right? And we do have shared governance, and there is a faculty.
What does that mean, shared governance?
So there's a faculty senate that has an opportunity. They make decisions around the curriculum, and they make decisions about initial decisions about personnel matters and policies. The end of the line, though, there's a president of the college.
It's you.
Right. And I have to make decisions in the best interest of the college. That's my role, is what's in the best interest of a four-year private thriving through a competitive time? What will we need to do? But they're invited to the table in a very respectful manner to talk about their discipline, the future of their discipline, how relevant it is, how important it might be, and where we need to go. In our campus master plan, they have a seat at the table. They can talk about what they believe their needs are. If it's not too much in the weeds, right? From my perspective, they have heard me talk about everything. And, you know, when I look back on my time at Springfield College, they will say I'm transparent. Whether they like it or not, I'm going to talk about what the issues are. And so this is a competitive time for four-year privates.
I want to get there because it's very important to me. Governor Baker, who has honored you by putting you on a very important commission, is obviously somebody who has to be a little bit sympathetic towards the private model. And we know that in some cases, some governors are not. But this guy is. What's happening to private education? I mean, and we sometimes call it private. Sometimes I get people angry at me and they call it independent. Doesn't matter. We know what it is. It's an alternative system. And some of these places are costing $60,000, $65,000 a year to go to, which prices them out with, against the state university, which may even now cost $20,000, which is unbelievable to me. That's a lot of money. And I want to remind everybody that we are talking to Mary Beth Cooper, Dr. Mary Beth Cooper, the 13th president of Springfield College. So in the old days in New York State, there used to be a thing called like CICU, KIKU, or the College Independence, and they would take offense at anything that the state schools got. That has stopped in New York. Has it stopped in Massachusetts?
I think so. Now, you have to think about Massachusetts for a minute.
We both live there.
Right. And you have to think about the other privates that I share the stage with, so to speak. And so some of the most well-known privates in the country and some of the most elite in the country, right? So
indeed. There's this little place called Harvard and MIT.
Right.
You know, all that. Yeah.
Right. Which is exciting. Now, I think private institutions have their work ahead of them, but they also, for many of them, have been around a long time. And they provide an opportunity for a certain kind of experience. Faculty-staff ratios, the lack of a lot of teaching assistants and graduates teaching courses. I mean, so I believe that, and certainly people that want a private education look to those variables, placement rates, retention rates. Some of the things we do very well happen at a place like Springfield College. The challenge is, and for parents and their students and prospective students, when they're looking for a fit, different individuals have a better fit with some of the smaller privates. And their personality is such, or they want to play Division III, or they want to study a particular topic, or they want to be in a smaller environment.
They couldn't have gotten into Harvard.
Right. All of those things. So I think all the challenges associated, certainly in New York State with the free tuition initiative, it's giving people cause to think about what is the value of education. And we talk about the prospect of return on investment. We talk about the value proposition and why we believe an experience at Springfield College is worth the cost. Now, we do not share the same pricing that you mentioned earlier, and so we are more affordable. 99% of our students get financial aid.
Okay, but how much does it cost if you were paying full boat?
Full boat total, if you are a full paying student, probably about $47,000.
So that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and we're very aware of it. But again, 99% of our students get some form of financial aid. And from my perspective, we work really hard to have it be affordable. You know, our increases, when you take a look at all of the schools that are cross-app schools, schools that we compete against for students, we are in the very lowest bracket of price increases. So we are very cognizant every time we have a price increase, where do we fall against our competition?
So obviously, one of the jobs of a president is to raise money. You have to go around. In order to give scholarships, you've got to have people who are giving you money so that you can afford to do that. Is that a job you like?
I do like it. I think it, too, very similar, and you mentioned in my comments earlier about the work we're doing now in enrollment management. It is far more data-driven than you would surmise. It's not just about going on a campus and liking the tour and getting a good feel of it. You have to have a good indication about what your prospective students are looking for, what the fit is like, what's the likelihood that they're going to come and go enroll at your school. Same with your donors. What's the propensity of them giving to your institution? Certainly, you're going to start with your alums that had a good experience at your institution, and many of them were had financial aid when they were there, and so they understand the value of giving back so that other students have the financial aid.
Well, how much of that do you have to do yourself? Obviously, you have people who do this kind of work and go around and talk to people, but do they bring you in for the ask?
They do bring me in for the ask, but we're also building a relationship, right? So for me, connecting with all of our donors and our friends and finding out what they're interested in, it's really far more about the donor than it is the institution.
Give me an example.
So we have a donor that provides an individual that speaks in the fall, a speaker series through our humanities,
yeah,
right?
Great.
He had a wonderful experience. He had a wonderful experience at Springfield College many years ago. He happens to also be a talent agent and has that opportunity to bring in different individuals. So Mitch Albom was on our campus this fall.
Right.
Beautiful job. He talked about his work in Haiti. He talked a lot about Tuesdays with Moore. He talked about giving and loving and just an incredible message. So for that donor to give us the opportunity to hear Mitch Albom is a gift, right? That's
sure.
He comes to us without payment out of the institution. And so the fun part about raising funds and raising friends is finding out what other people are really interested in. What was their favorite professor? What happened at Springfield College that they loved and that they want to make sure is not eroded? And so, like any good relationship, it takes work.
You know, that's very interesting that you say that, because I'm just thinking about it. New Paltz, where I taught for a long, long time, has a giving program. And then when somebody gets to give, they get to mention a professor that they really liked. And I get a few. I'm not saying I get thousands of them, but with some regularity, I've been getting them saying, you know, wanted to, you to know that you made an impression on them. That works, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Because students remember that. They remember the faculty that inspired them. And we hear it all the time. And we know through all of our national research that the most major impact on a college student during their 4 years are the faculty that are standing in front of them.
So I wanted to ask you about that. One of the great difficulties in our contemporary academic structure is that some people are full-time, but fewer and fewer, and then you have a lot of adjuncts doing this because it's the only way colleges and universities can survive economically in many cases. I'm not worried about Harvard and Yale, by the way, but I do understand that this is something. Somebody goes out and works real hard, gets a PhD, thinks this is going to be the life, and then they make $3,000 a course, and they teach two courses. I mean, that's got to be a real crisis in the academy, isn't it?
It is, and it is for some other institutions. I'm not saying it's not for us. We have a very robust full-time faculty. Now, our faculty are on 9.5-month contracts, so they are not employed during the summer. Most of them are not employed during the summer. The balance of how many adjuncts you bring on is, again, for four-year privates, a question we want to make sure that we answer the right way because people are paying for that.
So what would be the right way?
The right way in saying that you keep your, let's say we have 65% full-time and you go to a state school and it's 45%, or that they find a way to do that so they can reduce their costs. Well, we invest in people, right? And we have tenure. however you feel about the notion of tenure.
We'll talk about that.
Okay, we can talk about that. I should have really thought more about the fact I'm speaking to an emeritus faculty member, because you probably have a lot of thoughts about that.
Well, I do. You know, some mixed feelings. Our producer of this program is the inimitable David Gustina, who, in addition to his phenomenal work here, teaches at SUNY, teaches a course. And I have people coming up to me, students coming up to me all the time, saying, I have Professor Gustina. They do not know that he's not full-time. All they know is that he's the professor in the class. So I have never thought that bringing in outsiders, because I think the one thing that students love are professors who are doing it themselves and who can teach them about doing it, because I think that's what they're concerned with in their life. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that it's on balance, though, right? So you can bring in an adjunct specifically in a business program and talk about what's happening in the world of business. I taught 20 years, school of business at RIT and the School of Education at U of R. And they loved it because I was in the field. And I taught
exactly
four classes a year in both different schools, two different schools, and talked about, I was, you know, from my perspective, I went into the School of Ed and talked about how they need to be more business focused. And then I went to the School of Business and talked about how they need to be more focused on people and organization and development. And so it made it easy because I was offering a different perspective in those particular areas. And it kept me sharp in terms of knowing what college students are looking for. And I'll tell you, it gets more confusing now with all the technology and the iPads and
Indeed.
People checking their phones. They are distracted. And so some people complain about feeling the need to entertain students. Like, you didn't necessarily have that before. And so some faculty have parameters saying that you can't bring in technology to the class, but others say use it. If you're searching for something, find out, you know, tell me more about when that decision was made or how that was made. And somebody pulls their search engine up and looks at it. I do think it's a change for many faculty to get used to that.
We are talking with Dr. Mary Beth Cooper, the 13th president of Springfield College. Mary Beth, I want to ask you this. Do the students get to rate the professors?
Yes, they do. There are evaluation processes that every semester, at the end of the semester, there's a process that is robust, and that information goes up through the department chair, and those evaluations are looked at.
And how important is it when you decide to give somebody tenure? I've always thought cynically, write a book and you're done. I mean, you write a book in the academy, you're worth something. But you could be the most popular professor in the faculty, but that might not do it.
No, not for tenure. I mean, the role of scholarship and service are more important than popularity, right? And students are not all about the popularity of a professor. They understand better than you think that they're paying a lot of money for this education, and so they want the professor to be qualified, competent, and do their job, right? Because, you know, we have a lot of health sciences, and so that means the PA program, PT, OT, they have to know this material.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them, not only do they have to pass a certification, and they do quite well at Springfield College, they also have to go actually do that job. So the instruction can't be taken lightly.
Let me go into the minefield here. I'm sure you knew it was coming, but right now we have a lot of talk about sexual harassment on campuses. How do you deal with that?
Well, we have a very, you know, as any other fine institution would, we have policies and procedures so that when there is behavior that is in violation of one of our policies, there's a procedure that's clearly spelled out. I do think, and you know, we're thinking about this all the time,
sure,
that there's a lot of attention. Sadly, more attention now because Hollywood came to the scene,
yeah,
right? But the reality is there are consequences for behavior. And you've got to set the tone of the campus and talk about what is reasonable behavior and what you need to do to stay within those parameters. It's far more complicated today than it was 35 years ago when I went to college. And I understand that for a lot of reasons. But the government involvement in these issues with Title IX was very rigorous. And some might suggest that it wasn't all well thought out. And so I think what you're seeing now as that's being played out, some questioning about that. Do all people have rights? Are all the individuals, whether, you know, whoever's involved in the particular situation? More importantly, what kind of education happened on your campus to your new students as they come to campus, ongoing to for your regular students, training for your student athletes? The NCAA required it this year that there was a special session on sexual assault, harassment, and so you could define these terms that are hard to define and talk about consent, talk about bystander intervention. All of those are relatively new for higher education, I'd say, in the last 10 to 15 years, but I'm afraid we haven't seen the end of it.
But are there no-nos? I'll give you an example. I had a colleague at one place who fell in love with one of his students. And he came to each of us and said, I want to tell you about this. Is that okay? We're in love and, you know, we want to do it. They married. They had children eventually. And it was very nice. Nevertheless, there are some places who say absolutely no contact between a student and a professor.
And we're one of those places.
Are you?
Right. So that would
mean...
So if
that happened, I'm sorry, Mary Beth, but if that happened to you and somebody came and said, I just want to tell you, you know, Madam President, I want to tell you, Dr. Cooper, that I'm in love. I've met somebody. I couldn't help it. We're going to get married. You would say?
Here's how your partner might want to finish his or her education elsewhere. Well, I think, and I say that not to be flip, but the issue really underlying all of this is power, right? And so if I'm a professor and I fall in love with one of my students, there's a power differential that is problematic, right? Until that student is no longer in that power relationship. And so somebody has to move on. It's not fair to the student. It's not fair to the other students that are in the class. And I would wish them well. I'd be delighted if somebody fell in love, and especially to hear that it turned out so well for them. And it can happen, especially if you're passionate about the same topic. You can imagine why it would happen. If two people were really passionate about the history of Europe, and they found another person that was like-minded and had the same interests, so the likelihood of that is probable. But in the environment, the power differential makes for difficult decision making.
But just to be clear, I want to see if I heard right. You said you would say to the student.
Well, no, I'd say to either of them, right? Uh-huh. It's probably easier to transfer schools than it is if somebody's a tenured professor. That's a decision they have to make. Our policy is very clear about that relationship while a professor is employed by the college and a student is attending the institution.
Have you ever fired a tenured professor? I mean, I know at New Paltz, it happened. Somebody broke a law, somebody was involved in drugs, you know, something like that. President calls in the individuals and she says, you're fired. You say, you can't do that, I have tenure, whatever else. But it's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
Continuing appointment doesn't mean that there's no redress if somebody does something wrong.
Absolutely. So the answer is no, I have not. But there are policies and procedures in place, and we hold people accountable. Too many people are counting on us to hold people accountable. Students, their parents, whoever may be their financial sponsor, and the reputation, the branding of the college. You don't want to be a place where behavior like that is allowed and allowed to continue.
As you were coming up through the ranks, were you harassed?
I would find myself in situations where I felt uncomfortable or I felt a misuse of power. And I'll tell you that in most of those situations, took it within my own control to make sure it didn't happen again.
Want to give us a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah, everybody's got a boss. I have a boss. I've got 32 of them. I've got trustees. Yeah. You provide feedback to the person first and say, this is making me uncomfortable, or I feel like you're misusing your relationship. But those individuals report to somebody. And so you can file a complaint or you can go and talk with them. Hopefully it doesn't get to that point. It concerns me if people think they're above a policy or a procedure or the law, right? And many people do. Many people that get to a higher position do believe it doesn't pertain to them. And at the end of the day, it does.
Has there been a shift in the culture? I mean, you know, we see a zero tolerance type approach right now when it comes to this. It started with Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, do you think that we'll reach a level playing ground, or do you think that this is the new paradigm?
I think this is going to continue for a while, and the frenzy around it all is so many people have been impacted on this through their life that people are evaluating what has happened to them. So I think it's going to have a little bit more activity. In some ways, it's very sad because the best part of my day is interacting with other people. And if people feel that they can't say, that's a really nice shirt you have on, or boy, I really like that. And so you find people getting safer. And sometimes it doesn't feel as human as possible, you know. And there are times where if there's a student that's going through a very difficult time, or I'm attending a student funeral, and I am a person that tends to be more, I'm more willing to touch and hug a student that is looking to be hugged, can't do so much of that anymore, right? And so I do think the human factor is at risk, and that to me is well within parameters, and that's not a sexual harassment or sexual assault, but I do find that people are cognizant, and it's changing how people interact. And that's sad.
Do you like your job?
I love my job.
When you get up in the morning, what is it that you love so much about it?
Every day is different, mm-hmm. right? And I work at a great institution.
So you say every day is different. We have a saying around here, what fresh hell today? Because we don't know who's going to throw a hardball at our head. And every once in a while it happens. Listen, you got all kinds of people. You got faculty members. You got faculty members who may be Marxists. You got faculty members who may, frankly, get closer to the fascistic model and want to get in your face because you represent authority.
The administration.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. Well, I could have continued with every day's different because sometimes if yesterday was going to be repeated, you might not come back in the next day, right? So you're hoping it's different, and that doesn't happen. Those days are few and far between. But I work on a college campus with the brightest, most engaged young people in the world, and they are on their way somewhere. So when you think about the audience I work with every day, I'm working with a lot of hope. And so it's easy for me. Again, I go to the Wellness Center and I see some students and they're working on themselves. Our mission is spirit, mind, and body. Our students do a lot of service. Our students do about 120,000 hours of service a year compared to institutions like ours that are somewhere between 40 and 60,000.
Does the nature of the community count in something like this? Look, Springfield has not always been an easy place and it's got problems.
Right.
Does that mean the mission of the college is to intervene?
The mission of the college lays the groundwork for that. But again, as we started working with YMCA, so we've been affiliated with an organization that helps families and women and youth. And so it's no different that Cal Ripken Field that I talked to you about. Mm-hmm. We have a house on our campus, adjacent to our campus, is a deaf group home. So we have individuals that have aged out of the system in Massachusetts, 5 individuals that live in a house that's on our campus, and our students interact with them through Best Buddies and ASL. That's a state-funded home, and so we have an interaction there. So we've got lots of partnerships like that where we're working with the youth of Springfield. I sit on a number of committees for the city of Springfield. We're very committed to Springfield.
And what about internships?
Internships at all those places. Internships, for all of our health services at the local hospitals. Our students do a lot of work in alternative spring breaks. We'll be going down to Haiti in the spring with 5 or 6 other alternative spring breaks.
Who organizes that? To you?
There's a group through student affairs. We have an individual that works with community service, and so she coordinates those trips. And some of our donors help us with that. So they go do Habitat. I've been on a Habitat with them. I'm going to Haiti with them. And so they're committed to helping other people. Most of our graduates work in fields where they help other people. So it's really unique, and I know I can come across really Pollyanna-ish about it, but we have a unique culture that is about other people. And so going to work every day is not hard.
What would you do if you had a state legislator come to you and say, this guy wrote a column about me somewhere, or he said something about me, I want him fired? What would you do? The only reason I asked that question is because it happened to me. I was the subject of that. And the president of the college at the time said, can't do it. He has tenure. And I've often kidded around, say, thereby setting a precedent for the first case of what tenure really should be used for.
Correct.
In history. So what would you do?
I'd say I'm sorry that happened. And have you thought about free speech? I wouldn't necessarily use a tenure card. We have a lot of speakers that come to campus that have different opinions than my own. And I follow the University of Chicago model of the notion that college campuses is where discourse needs to happen. And sometimes you like it and sometimes you don't. And so that's another emerging area that a lot of colleges are getting in trouble over. And can you do that? And I don't like that graduation speaker and they don't have the same opinion. We have lost our ability to really be intellectually inspired by differing opinion.
Well, what if they stand up at the graduation and turn their backs to the speaker? Free speech?
Certainly free speech. Now, I will tell you, I would be more careful about my commencement speakers than I would somebody that's coming in to do a lecture or a forum on campus, right? Because you don't want to be divisive. Graduation really is about the students and their families, and maybe sometimes even more for the families, especially those that are first generation. It's a period of celebration. We want to put somebody in front of you that is going to say congratulations and good luck, give back, whatever. But I'm not sure commencement is where you want to invite discourse.
Dr. Mary Beth Cooper, of course, is the 13th president of Springfield College. Mary Beth, I guess I got to ask you this. You give out honorary doctorates, I take it.
We do.
Yeah. I'm sure you've given them to people who may, at some point in their life, run into crisis. So, for example, some places want to take Harvey Weinstein's honorary doctorate away from him. I'm sure when that happens and you read it in the paper, you say, what would I do?
I know exactly what I'd do. Take it to the trustees. The trustees confer the honorary degrees, and I'm sure as when you have received yours. So they giveth and they can taketh away. We did go through that with Bill Cosby 2 years ago.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm. Because we started to see the movement early on about other colleges and universities rescinding his honorary degree.
And he had one from you.
He did. He spoke a number of years ago prior to my arrival on campus. And so then you ask the question, do you want to be at the front end of that decision? Do you want to be in the middle of the pack, or do you want to be the last in with Bill Cosby? And they were allegations. Right? This was early in some of the activity surrounding him. And for me, it was fascinating because the trustees really debated this topic. And for us, and I think it's a good way to think about or frame the conversation, the activity that he was allegedly involved in is in direct opposition to what we stand for as a college. And if we had had that information, probably they wouldn't have invited him to be the commencement
speaker.
Oh, I'm sure.
Right? Yeah.
And so they voted. It was a very robust conversation, and we have lawyers on our trustees as well. And so lots of people were talking about the legal parameters associated with that. And at the end of the day, they decided to rescind it. And then we were early in that. So
we had to tell him.
We have a lawyer. Send him a letter. We have in-house counsel that sent him a letter and said, you know, this was a decision that the trustees made. And it was good for the trustees to discuss it. But when you look at the situation, it's still a very sad situation. And so people came to that disappointed in what had transpired.
It's interesting, you know, the Cosby Show is still on the television at night. And you can watch it. President Cooper, I wanted to ask you, newspapers, journalists. We know that some of what makes for contemporary journalism is gotcha journalism. Gotcha, you know, we caught you at this or they caught you at that. And so one has got to be very careful with what one says to a journalist. I know you have an amazing advisor in Steve Roulier, but sometimes you can't help it. You know, you just got to think on your feet as this stuff is happening.
Like right now?
Not at all. Have you? I'm a big fan of yours. Do you respect journalists, period? No, question mark. Do you respect journalists?
I do, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's the predictable right answer. But in your soul of souls, do you ever say, when you see their name show up on the call answering machine, do you ever say, uh-oh, I better watch out here?
No,
I don't. You know all the rules? So a rule might be, for example, does one understand what off the record means and all that stuff when you're dealing with people? Or do you want to be as open as you seem to be with me today?
First, we'd have to take a step back. You have to be doing whatever you're doing in an ethical manner. So if you got something to hide, you've got a bigger problem, right?
Indeed.
And if you've made a mistake, you have to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times, and I learned that early in my career, if we've made a mistake about something, or you feel slighted or that I've done something, it doesn't cost me anything to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you feel this way. I'm sorry this happened. How can we get to a better place? So if you are doing things within a proper manner, then you shouldn't get caught a gotcha. Now, I'm sure there are people that want to catch me or catch the institution doing something.
But clearly, Mary Beth, you've seen instances where you say, that story just wasn't fair.
Right. But they have to report the news. Right. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we haven't had a lot of negative press. There have been things that have happened that you wish don't make the paper. And mm-hmm. I read the paper every morning.
Sure.
I still get the hard copy. But I grew up in D.C. and I was reading the Washington Post and the Washington Star. And it was a different time. But I had great respect for broadcasting then in terms of, you know, who we had, Walter Cronkite coming in. And at the time, again, growing up in D.C., the news was very bipartisan, and it wasn't set out to agitate you. And there were certainly a lot of things in the 60s happening in D.C. that could agitate you, but it felt more, not necessarily fair. They were reporting more facts.
Than now?
Than now. I would say that's my personal opinion.
Well, of course you're right.
Right.
So that leaves you with a problem. In that it's not as fair now as it used to be.
If they want to target something that we're doing on this campus, but again, if you're living with some kind of moral compass.
Sure, I agree with that.
Then you, those are the things that don't worry me.
Let's assume, okay. Let's just assume terribly, because I've seen it at NYU once where I did my doctorate, a lot of people, they've had several suicides. And when somebody jumps off the Bob's library or something like that, obviously, a reporter's going to come on and say, well, why did he do it? Was there too much pressure? Was this student-to-student pressure? The rest of it. Then you really need to know what you're doing when you respond to the reporter. You could make a mistake. You could say the wrong thing.
Right. And you're sorry that that tragedy happened on your campus. Right. I mean, it's a very sad occasion for the family. And it's not about the institution. And so when we did earlier in my career, when I was at another institution, we had a number of suicides over a period of time. And mental health is real and alive on college campuses. And if you don't have proper counseling systems in place, and you've got to resource that, you absolutely have to make that a priority. Having said that, students, you know, certainly talk about loneliness and stress, and that you've got to provide opportunities for them to talk about it. We talk to parents about students should always be able to call their parent. And earlier in my career, I learned that sometimes when a student said, I can't, you know, my dad will kill me or my parents will disown me, you say, gosh, no, they won't. Well, sometimes they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so from my perspective, if that happens on a campus, and again, I've lived through and gone to far too many student funerals in my career, did the college do everything they could for him or her? You're certainly seeing a lot in higher education, fraternities and sororities, what's happening with them moving forward and the hazing. Colleges have to do the right thing. They have to correct the cultures that are causing those situations. We don't have fraternities and sororities at Springfield College. And
good for you.
It makes my job a little bit easier. But you have to talk about hazing. You have to talk about the consequences of that. And you put some things in place where if somebody has consumed too much alcohol, what are the reporting mechanisms? And so what do you do to make sure a student gets help?
There was at least one college in our 5-state area, let's say, where a woman who thought she had been wronged was walking around with a mattress on her back.
Yes.
And that could be hellish for a college president.
Certainly. Now, if I remember the story correctly, there from her perception, something was not done properly.
Right.
So you fix the system, right? Moving forward, you may not be able to help what happened to her. But the worst thing for you to do is not correct what seemed to be the problem so that students again and again are confronted with the same issue and the same barrier to what they believe is fair access or being heard. Or because all you can provide is a system that is reasonable, right?
Have you ever made a faculty decision, a tenure decision, where you knew that it went down so hard, the person couldn't accept it, that you had an enemy for the rest of your life?
Yes.
How do you handle it?
Those kind of decisions, you do learn, and I'm learning more and more with every year of employment, whether it's the president or a vice president. There are decisions that are unpopular, but they're not personal, right?
Not to you.
Right. Personal to the individual. But, you know, even when you have a staff member that is in the position that's not a good fit for them, doing the humane thing and helping people make different decisions. If I made a decision about a tenure that was supported by the evidence that was in front of me, right, and then the procedures were followed, what can you do to help that person find the next role? Where can they land where they have their dignity? And I think it's easy for me just to say,
no, you're right.
You know, they don't like me. But people have houses and families and lives. And when you make a decision, I'm cognizant of that. But you also have to give people an out so that they can go out with grace or do the next thing and provide a way to make amends.
We only have a few more minutes, but I wanted to ask you this. And I want to remind everybody, you're talking to Dr. Mary Beth Cooper, the 13th president of Springfield College. Let me ask you this. We have a president of the United States who is warning about the evils of bringing outsiders into this country. Obviously, one of the great things about any university is the ability to have different types of people there from different places. You got a couple of seconds on that one?
Sure. I think it's not only the international students that come to our campus that benefit from the educational opportunities. By far, it's our domestic students that have an opportunity to engage with international students. It's a very dangerous area, and I think it's short-sighted, and I am hoping that an outcome is different than what it seems to be headed towards.
Does your campus security have guns?
They do. They've been armed for a little over 3 years. That decision was made prior to my arrival, but that's fine.
I take it they wanted that. The security people
they
wanted
did. And it's important for a lot of different reasons. It's important for them. They go through an incredible amount of training, psychological training and hands-on training before they get a firearm in their hands, right? Because you worry that at a split second something happens and things go wrong.
Sure.
Right? But you can't live through a time where you have a Virginia Tech. And I can list all of them as you can as well. If only it serves as a deterrent for people to come on our campus and pull out their own guns, I'll take it. Because it, for me, safety at all levels is probably the highest priority for our students and our faculty. And it's tragic what's happened nationally with all of these outbursts of violence.
So when it happens, if it happens, if, God forbid, it happens on your campus, have you established, and we only have a minute or two here, have you established rules that people have to sort of, you know, hide in place, or does everybody know what to do?
They do. I would say that, you know, all of our community, we have new community members all the time, new students that come in, and certainly new faculty that come in. And so there is training for a response. The most important piece, though, is to train your police officers, because they really manage the situation, right? So there's that piece, and then there's an alert process, and we do training through technology. There's lots of different ways. The reality of it is, no matter how prepared you are, sometimes these things happen instantaneously. So people need to be aware. We do all that training in terms of being cognizant of where you're walking and how people know where you're at, how you can use your technology to make sure people are connected. By the grace of God, we hope that everybody remains safe.
Dr. Mary Beth Cooper is the 13th president of Springfield College. I have so enjoyed this, Mary Beth. You know, sometimes, it goes a little slow. You really are good, and I so appreciate your honest and frank approach to the way this all goes. I so loved having you here.
Thank you. It was really delightful, and you made it easy, so I appreciate that. It was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.